people who have eating disorders are like some of the neatest people I've met in life. You know, they're highly sensitive people often. They see eating disorders as a way of surviving.
Welcome to another episode of the Pillow Four Sessions podcast. I'm Nicole, and my guest virtually in the Pillow Four today is Claire. And we are going to be talking about something that I know very little about, which is eating disorders. And so, so glad that you reached out to me about this. I feel like it's a topic that a lot of people go into this field really wanting to cover and wanting to work with. And so I am ready to learn for sure. So thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
So first question, of course, is why did you decide to become a therapist / social worker instead of becoming, I don't know, a professional pet groomer or something?
Well, that's a great question. I didn't even know there were such things as pet groomers back in those days. yeah, that's a great question. So I come from a family of actors. And I grew up in New York City. And my family, both my parents had been in therapy. And I grew up in kind of the New York Jewish world where therapy was a common practice, and I grew up hearing about it a lot, and my parents were very interested in that. My parents were all socially conscious people and very progressive and really talked about concerns about the world. So, and I also grew up at a time when New York was in really bad shape, and there were a lot of homeless people. And I know when I was in like fifth grade and I had to write a story in school, I wrote about the homeless lady who lived next door to my apartment. And I was always curious about her and curious about what went through her mind and what her life had been like before she lived there. So I think those pieces kind of set the stage for me. And also then one other thing, when I was in sixth grade, and I still have this, we had to write an autobiography, and I wrote, when I grow up, I will absolutely, positively, without a doubt, be an actress. Nice. But if I'm not, I will be a psychiatrist. That's how I wrote it. S-K-I, something like that. But it started S-K-I. It was the only word I knew for those people who, and I said in the autobiography, I said, because I'm fascinated with how the mind works, how the brain works. I was always curious about what made people tick.
Yeah.
And I was also just kind of that person that all their friends came to talk about problems.
Yeah. You're not the first person that's been in the Pillow Fort that says, I had that role before I got paid for it. This has always been my thing. And you said you were five when you wrote that?
No. I was in sixth grade when I wrote that. Yeah.
That's amazing. So from the beginning, you were like, if acting doesn't work out, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah. And I dropped acting after ninth grade. So, and I have to say, I didn't always know what I wanted. I went to college with the intention of studying psych, and I did. I fell into a social psychology class that professor became kind of a mentor to me. But then I studied other things, and I was interested in Spanish literature and anthropology. And then I took time off, and then I studied graphic design for a while.
Okay.
And I wanted artist. So what finally happened when I was 23 And I was planning to move out to New Mexico and just find an artist and apprentice for an artist and, again, drop out of art school at that point. And my mom encouraged me to think about maybe trying to at least get some academic credit for what I was planning to do in New Mexico. And I gave, so I had to write an essay to get this academic credit for it. And the woman at this school that where you were able to get credit for life experience, she said, well, why do you want, I mean, if you're going to be an artist, why do you even need a bachelor's degree? And I said, well, because probably someday I'm going to be a therapist. And so she said, well, okay, fill out the essay. And as I was writing the essay and I was saying, you know, this is really important to me. I know someday I want to be a therapist. And it just, a light bulb went off in my head. Wow. And I walked out the door of that, that building, and I went to the payphone and I called my advisor from the new school where I had been working on my degree, but taking mostly art related classes. And I had told her I was moving out to New Mexico. I wasn't coming back. And I called her and I said, I am coming back. I want to graduate within a year. I'm going to take all psych classes and I'm going to grad school. And she said, but you've been going part-time and you've been stressed. Right. And I said, yep. And I'm going to go full-time and I'm going to do it. And if I come back to you in 2 months and tell you I was crazy, I'll come back to you in 2 months and tell you I was crazy. But this is what I want. And I never looked back. It was the right time and the right place. And I moved back home with my parents to finish up. And I got the best grades I ever got before. And I studied Jung that year and took a class where we read plays and then talked about the family dynamics in the plays. And so we learned psychology through the theater productions that we read. And so it was very clear to me after that. I was just, from that moment forward, I knew where I was going. And I was 24 and, well, I graduated at 24 and went on to grad school. And I've loved my career.
That's so amazing. Like we sort of talked about last night over the phone, you know, you are far into your career. And so it's nice. You know, so far, everybody I've talked to is in the same place as me, where we're little baby therapists, but you have taken your degree and sort of are living the dream of, I found something I'm passionate about, and I jumped into it, you know, feet first, and now I can say that I have my own practice. And so, fast forwarding into how do you find yourself working specifically on eating disorders?
You mean, how did I end up doing that?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So, once I got really clear what I wanted to do, I think at that point I just wanted to be a therapist. Mm-hmm. But when I started social work school, we had to fill out a paperwork that said, what if we had a dream job? What it would be. And I said, I wanted, talk about a specific dream. I wanted to live in the Southwest and work on reservations with Native Americans who suffer with eating disorders. And I am not 100% sure how I put all those pieces together, but I had an interest in Native American spirituality and I knew I was interested in eating disorders because I had been working on my own at that point. Okay. Then what they told us basically is that whatever those visions were, to just kind of put them on the shelf while we were in grad school and just learn everything they had to offer us. And I did. I loved my experience of grad school. And while I was there, I wasn't 100% sure I would go into private practice. I loved just the public mental health components and worked in a jail and all that. But then when I finished grad school, I moved out to Florida and I knew that there was an eating disorder treatment center there that was very reputable. And so when I knew I was moving to that area, I contacted them and I was able to get a job working for them. And the work is just so deep and so And the people who have eating disorders are like some of the neatest people I've met in life. You know, they're highly sensitive people often. They see eating disorders as a way of surviving. And so I see it that they found a way to cope with whatever it was they needed to cope with, whatever was happening inside, whether to regulate their nervous system, to cope with trauma, or to manage attachment distress, or whatever it was that, and it was not typically one or two or three things. It was layers of what occurred for that person in their lives and internally, but that the eating disorder becomes how they coped. And so it's a creative solution. It's time limited and it's not effective long term, but it is quite wise in many ways. And so I always work from the perspective of the gestalt, the whole, mm-hmm. that this person's symptoms were an attempt to be whole. And so that's kind of how I stumbled into it, and then had this just amazing experience at the Renfrew Center where I learned a lot about how to work with eating disorders. I learned about the details of eating disorders and the dynamics.
That's all of that is so amazing. So I'm trying to like piece it all together. And so before we get back to, I want to get back to your lived experience and the novelty, or like the, how people you say that have eating disorders have sort of found this, unique way of dealing with this. I want to get back to that. But first I want to start at like 101. Okay. So I know of anorexia nervosa and bulimia, and I think that's just the terminology that I know. So what is the difference, and what do those look like?
Okay. So the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders has now added some other components, and so I want to just kind of honor all the different dimensions. Okay. And I haven't specialized in all of them because one is actually fairly new. I have some associates who specialize in them, but I haven't. Okay. So yes, anorexia restricting type. They now look at anorexia binge purge. Okay. And then there's, of course, bulimia. Which is typically binging and then some kind of compensatory mechanism to deal with the food that's been taken in. So whether it's purging by self-induced vomiting or use of laxatives or compulsive exercise or various other things that someone might find. And then the newer one that's been acknowledged, and then there's binge eating disorder, which is more recently acknowledged. It's, of course, been around since the beginning of time, but it wasn't acknowledged as an eating disorder. And I have to say that's my own history. And when I was a teenager and I would diet and then binge and then diet and then binge and then diet and binge, and my life was very consumed with it, I knew that I had an eating disorder even though nobody else did. Even though in the world that I lived in at the time, people would just say that I, you know, ate too much, okay. You know, or like, you know, that person's always dieting. But I knew that what I did with food was not normal, and was so for me, getting help from an eating disorder specialist was pretty significant in my life. But going back to the newest diagnosis that has been identified is called ARFID, which stands for Avoidant and Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. And these are the people, I want to say the kids, because it's often diagnosed in kids, but of course the kids grow up. Right. But these are the people who used to be called picky eaters. Okay. But sometimes the extremity of the picky eating can leave them nutritionally deficient. They can, it can impact their growth. They can appear to be anorexic because they're so fearful or resistant to trying different foods and new foods. But it's not a fear of weight gain.
It's a fear of the trying, the new thing.
It's a fear of the food itself. It's a fear of the food itself. And it, yes, it can be connected to a fear of new things. But the food itself, often there's a textural component to it. Okay. There can be smell components. It's very sensorial usually. I know for myself in the past when I worked with somebody previous, if I were to have worked with that previously, I would typically contact an occupational therapist to address from the sensory component. And that's some of what eating disorder specialists who are trained to work with ARFID do. There's also attachment components to it. And I don't really want to speak too much to it because I'll butcher it. It's not something I specialize in.
That's okay. That's brand new to me. And I feel like that's probably one of those things, because it's so new and because it happens in kids, that people just completely are like, that kid is just picky. If I just force them to eat this stuff or they have to sit at the table until they finish it, then that'll fix that. So I think, I would imagine there's a lot of kids out there with that who are not getting the help that they need.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Having that diagnosis has been really helpful to a lot of parents, I think, who have worried about their kids for years. I have a friend who for years would ask me about her kid. And now I have a team and a few of them specialize in it. So... because they got that training in one of the treatment centers where they worked. So,
that is super interesting. And when you say kids, you mean like young kids?
Young kids. I mean, that's we see that sometimes in, I mean, it can be as young as, you know, 5, 6 years old. But certainly I'm hearing about it in 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds. What we sometimes see in boys when they have that, when they get into adolescence, they become a little more distressed about it because they want to bulk up. They want to, get – that's part of the body image that kicks in in adolescence. And but they're still struggling with how to do that because they're fearful of food.
Right, right. There's only so many things I can eat.
Yeah. So some of like my associates who do that work will do a lot with, and but when I say associates, I mean, my associates who are therapists and then also dietitians who specialize with that will do work around food explorations where they might once a week have a new taste together in work and try something.
It sounds a little bit like exposure.
Exposure. It's yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's yeah, exactly.
That's so interesting. That's crazy. In a good way, because it's like, I don't know why my mind is always blown by the brain, but every time I learn something new, I'm like, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
So I want to talk about anorexia and bulimia. With those, what do you typically see as far as people who suffer with it and age ranges? Who does that look like? Who are most likely affected by it?
Well, it actually is really, really a wide range. I mean, we typically see it starting as young as, I mean, it is not typical to see it as young as 10 years old, but it can happen. Mm-hmm. It does happen, you know. And I would say most typically what we see is middle to high school up to senior citizens. Wow. And I worked with people well into middle age and beyond who suffer with it. And whether it's restricting, purging, and, you know, of course, overeating, binge eating disorder, any of it, if it's not treated, sometimes the symptoms can go underground for a while.
Yeah.
But if they don't, and there are people who, for whom it might resolve. I think typically if it's untreated, it's going to revisit in some way, if not in one's own relationship with food, then perhaps in how they parent.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of times when we work with kids or teens, college kids who have eating disorders, what we'll find out is that a parent, more often a mom, but not exclusively, might say, oh, yeah, I had that in college, too.
Okay.
And they may not have gotten help for it. And it may have just gone quiet. They may have stopped restricting to the point where they were consumed with it all the time. They may have stopped purging, let's say. But that doesn't mean they weren't still rigid or anxious around food. And so then they may have created a home environment that highly valued size and
physical appearance, like a certain body type. So even with not on purpose, not sort of like displaying those behaviors, like you said, but even just talking about food in a certain way can sort of bring up that for kids.
Yeah. And going back to something I was saying before about there's never one factor. It's always multi-layered. So a parent having their own rigidity or anxiety around size doesn't equal a kid having an eating disorder. But if that kid has psychological predispositions, genetic predispositions, high sensitivity, what we call the small T and the big T traumas in life. So if not significant, obvious traumas in life, all humans have what I call the small T traumas of, friend crises or academic things that just go in to the nervous system as a trauma in a subtle and unseen way and may fail to experience healing and repair in the attachment systems of that individual. So those layers together could lead to someone being inclined towards developing an eating disorder.
So forgive me if this comes off as a judgmental question, but it's hard for me as a person who has control issues to see the link between stressing at school and having this relationship with food, maybe eating too much or eating too little to fix it. So where do people who live with this have that connection where, well, this will make it better? Because for me, on the outside, I'm like, those two aren't even related.
Right. I'm glad. I'm so glad for you. And it's not judgmental. It is. I mean, I think any problem we don't have can be hard for us to imagine. And that's why as social workers, we inquire, we're curious, how does that come to be? How do you make those connections? What I've discovered, what I believe, is that for someone with an eating disorder, hunger and appetite comes to be representative of unmet needs and intolerable feelings.
Okay.
So the hunger, so food and hunger, we're talking about an eating disorder. They're not really about.
Sorry.
So if I give you an example, we love dogs. It's okay.
I knew this was going to happen at some point. He saw a bird. It happens on every episode.
That's all right. I know. I was hoping mine would be quiet while we're doing this too. So far, so good. So, you know, I'll give you an example of someone with an eating disorder who may have academic stress. Mm-hmm. May have, because of whatever their early experiences in life, their attachment issues, the messages they got in childhood, perhaps, of I can't be needy, I can't struggle. This should be easy for me. And then let's say then there's also maybe a social issue that happens either in a relationship or with, you know, a romantic relationship or with a roommate or in the family, something's going on, but there's some needs that person's nervous system can't manage that feels intolerable to be sad. Mm-hmm. Not that they would say, well, I won't allow myself to be sad, but their personality structure may have developed in such a way that they won't let themselves sit with sadness. They may stay really busy in order to not be sad. They may go running in order to not be sad. They may always be involved in clubs and school government and dance team or whatever, so that they're going and going and going and going and going and never sitting with the pain, right, whatever that pain is in their life, because we all have pain. And so so it isn't just the academic stress that you see and you say, therefore, I'm going to control what I eat. But when all these things layer up, if there's also a component that is triggered around food, weight, restricting, maybe going on a diet. Going on a diet can actually be a predisposing factor to an eating disorder if someone's got all those layers in place. So, you know, we in our field are very anti-diet. So the need, it's the need to control, and you said you're a controlling person, but for you, the wires aren't linked together around, if I control my food, I won't be this stressed and I'll be able to focus on my schoolwork.
No, it's about other stuff. So just like any other way to cope, I guess it's just a different linkage on how to deal with, to feel like you're in control of the situation. Yeah. Or to meet another need that hasn't been met.
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't know why that makes total sense. I don't know why I thought hadn't connected that, but that makes plenty of sense. So for you, you said that you were going through it yourself. Mm-hmm. How did you manage it while also working with other people who were going through it? Or were you working with people then?
Well, let's see. I started grad school. I mean, I was in therapy from the time I was 20, intensively, I would say, from the time I was 20 till about 26, 27. But when I was in grad school is when I started working with an eating disorder specialist. And so I had already done a lot of family dynamic work with a therapist before that, who really helped me to do some deconstruction work around the roles in my family. And so I had come a long way already, and my food had moved from more chaotic eating to more controlled eating. Okay. And so instead of binging, I was following a very rigid meal plan. So I'd kind of swung the other way. It felt much saner to me, but I was pretty preoccupied with food. And so then I found a therapist in eating disorders and started doing some really deep work. And, and started questioning some of the rules, the food rules, because no therapist had asked those kind of things before. So during that time, I was working in the field, but not with people with eating disorders. And it really wasn't until a few years later when I moved to Florida and started working at the Renfrew Center. And by then, my eating disorder was I was pretty well into recovery. Okay. I will say the last food rule that I struggled with was around allowing myself sweets. And that really resolved itself during my early months of working in eating disorder treatment. It just was, I got so much normalizing of recovered eating by working with those people.
So it was actually helpful. It was actually pretty helpful.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, when people are new in the field and they ask me sometimes, you know, but if I've had an eating disorder, can I do this work? Right. I think you have to be enough in your recovery that you're able to, you know, I'm sure you remember in school when we talk about countertransference.
Right.
And the things that our clients are going to bring up in ourselves.
Right.
So we have to be far enough in our own work that when things get triggered from the work, that we're able to work with it ourselves, get the help that we need, but transfer it into appropriate work with our clients rather than the unrecovered reactivity would of course do harm to our clients. So I think by the time I was doing that work, I was already pretty well into recovery myself.
That's amazing. And that was exactly what I was thinking, because they say, you know, be careful about countertransference. Be careful about being triggered by your clients. And, you know, of course, during grad school, we spent so much time, you know, digging up our own stuff so that we could process it. So when we got ready to go in the field, you know, we weren't crying during session when people say stuff. But it sounds like, you know, that you were in a healthy place.
Yeah, and actually, countertransference is one of them.
Oh, you're fine. I think so, too. I think it's a way to connect with people.
Countertransference is one of the most interesting things in our field. I absolutely love it because we are human beings to come up for us. No matter how much work we've done and how far along we are, stuff is going to come up for us. But it's learning how to feel it in our bodies when it comes up, how to notice. I mean, I love using my countertransference to inform what's happening with my client.
Yeah.
If I'm feeling kind of sleepy and disconnected, sometimes I'll ask myself, is there something going on with my client where they're wanting to push me away? Are they feeling like it's difficult to connect with people? And am I taking that on? Am I having, in essence, a projective identification where I will take on their feeling because they're not aware they're having it? So then I might explore what connection is like for them. And it always, whenever I use my own experience to inform what's happening with the other person, it always leads me to fruitful places.
Sorry, I had to sneeze. I appreciate you taking up for that. I feel like feeling your feelings, aka countertransference, is often looked on as a bad thing, but I think it's fine.
It's human.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good segue. In the time that we have left, how are you taking care of yourself now? I mean, you're far in your career. Now you have your own practice with your own therapist. And how's life? you're a professional now.
Yeah, I love that question. It's great. And it's a really important one, and it's something I talk to my team about a lot because it's really important. We can't, in essence, take care of others, you know, if we're not taking care of ourselves. I try to walk my dog every morning and make sure I look at the trees and notice the shape of the sky against the trees and the houses and notice, just be present. So I try to do that. When my pool is open, I like to swim. That's a way that I carry my body, and my whole psyche is, it's very healing for me. I talk to people. I have close people in my life, family members and friends and colleagues. A lot of my good friends are also colleagues. So they're great to talk to. I have a wonderful daughter that I have a lot of fun with and connect with her. If I'm going through something difficult, I will turn to people. And, you know, I'm grateful that I have that resource. Another way that I'm taking care of myself is by feeding myself meals. And that was something that was really important to me that I noticed when the whole pandemic started. Is the first week, my eating routine was just, well, and my everything routine was off, and certainly my eating. I was very used to getting coffee at Starbucks in the morning and bringing breakfast with me to work and eating it on the way, and then running over to Saladilla at lunch to grab something. I was not doing a lot of cooking. I was not feeding myself at home. So I wasn't in the habit. And so after 1 week, I kind of made a whole very clear intention for myself that I am going to feed myself meals at home every day. And it has been really, it's been wonderful. I love sitting down for breakfast at home and lunch and dinner and snacks. And often sitting outside if the weather is nice. So I really can't, that's really helped my mental health. And puzzles.
I have a puzzle
going at all times. It's very relaxing. I'm also like always trying to do something creative. So right now I'm working on a little lettering project where I cut out letters and paint them, and
That's so cool. I admire you really being intentional about cooking. I had the same experience when this whole thing started. I don't know how to cook at all. At all. And my partner is not the best at it either. And so the two of us were like, well, if restaurants close, we will starve. And so we've had to learn. Luckily some drive-thrus are still open, but we've had to spend more time in the kitchen eating meals that we cook for ourselves, or else I'll just sit and not eat. And so I know for people who are struggling or in recovery of an eating disorder, this must be a tough time. You're out of control of a situation. There's a lot of stress involved, and a routine that you may have had around food or access you may have had to food is also all jumbled up. And so I think that that's going to be some really good advice to people, is just, you got this.
You've spoken to two things I would love to speak to. One is, I want to give a shout out to something. The eating disorder community has really rallied beautifully. And within days of the stay-at-home order, they started an Instagram joint meal activity every hour on the hour all around the world. And so if you go on Instagram to COVID-19 eating support, no dashes, nothing, just COVID-19 eating support, you can go to their site, and on the hour, almost every hour, some eating disorder specialist around the world, a dietitian or a therapist who specializes in eating disorders, will eat a meal or a snack while they are live on Instagram.
That's amazing.
And so people who have eating disorders who want support can be on and watching them, and they can write in on their phones. They can write in questions. They can say what they're snacking on or what they're eating at that time. It's so moving to me, and I've done it a couple of times, and it's really moving to see everybody on it. So that's one thing that I wanted to share. And then the other thing you spoke to about, you saying, you know, we're going to starve, but look, you didn't starve. You're learning something. You're growing. And something I've always been really passionate about is crisis theory. And I remember when I first learned it, and I draw it for my clients sometimes because I'm very visual. So I have a visual that I draw out of like this line. We go along in life at whatever our baseline is in life. And it's a health term, you know, like whatever your baseline is for health, whatever your baseline is for mental health, whatever your baseline is for functioning. And when a crisis hits, and I draw it like a lightning bolt, you can't go along business as usual anymore.
Right.
And if we don't do anything when a crisis hits, sometimes we're going to lower our baseline. Mm-hmm. And then whatever our functioning, we may go lower. But if we see a crisis as an opportunity and we choose to do something different with it, like you're learning how to feed yourself, you're learning how to make food, I'm learning how to use all the food that I've always kept in my house, but I always let it go bad.
Right.
I'm cooking, and it's not that difficult, and it tastes pretty good.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm not anxious anymore in the kitchen. And so I'm increasing my baseline around self-care through this. And so when all this comes out, when all this is over, I will come out of it having grown, and hopefully in a variety of ways.
Right. Your baseline might be a little bit higher. You might be better normally.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's what baseline. Yeah. Better normally is a great verbiage for that. I like that.
Well, I hope that that happens for a lot of people. I hope that that happens for me. But I appreciate you sharing that Instagram. I think I'm so glad that that is happening, especially for people who are feeling out of sorts and out of whack. That is some consistency that happens globally.
Yeah.
That is a great precedent for everything that we need to happen right now.
I know.
But I'm so glad that you are doing this work, and I'm so glad that there are people that are so passionate about it and who are so knowledgeable about it. If people are feeling like they might be struggling with this, how do they find you and contact you?
Oh, okay. My practice is called CAS Counseling. So CAS and then counseling.
Okay.
And that is our website, is CASCounseling.com. So they are welcome to go on the web and us. We have several associates. We all specialize in eating disorders, and we do have openings. We're doing all telehealth right now, and we'd be really happy to help people.
Love
it.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that
and it feels
sense.
Really. Sorry.
Go ahead. Welcome to telehealth. Welcome to telehealth.
Yeah, right. Welcome to telehealth. Exactly. Welcome to telehealth, stepping on each other's toes a little bit. No, I just have to say, like, I feel really lucky. Obviously I'm lucky to be able to work through this, but it feels really amazing to watch the world going through what the world is going through now and know that my job every day helps people 1 hour at a time.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm able to give something to people, whether it's groups, individuals, but it just feels really meaningful at a time when just the world is suffering a lot to, I think we're really lucky to do. I mean, I feel that way in our field all the time. I feel like we're very, very lucky to be in a field where we can help people.
Yep. Yeah. I feel like I'm struggling with my own mental health, but helping other people with theirs not only makes me feel like I'm not alone in my struggle, but that I can assist in a way that maybe some other people cannot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm so impressed with you.
Thank you so much.
I'm so impressed with you. You're young, you're educated, and you're sharp as a whip and creative to have come up with this idea and be able to do it with as just articulate and authentic.
Thank you so much.
And wise, and I love it. I'm really impressed.
So much. I am so interested in this field now. Like I said, I have very little knowledge. And so I hope this isn't the last time that we talk, for sure. I have a billion other questions.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to continue the conversation off air anytime. I'd love that.
Thank you so much.
I'd love to know more about your interests and dreams and visions professionally.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Well, we will definitely make that happen. Hopefully in person when the world gets back together, gets it together. But for now, thank you so much for being on the podcast, joining me virtually in the pillow fort. I know this is a little bit weird. And thank you so much for your patience with this weird, this weird way of doing it.
It's been great, Nicole. Thank you.
Thank you. I do want to get a quick picture, but before we do that, I just want to say thank you for listening to the Pillow Fort Sessions podcast. We'll see you in a week or so. A week, or I don't even know. We'll see what Corona has to say about that. Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Pillow Fort Sessions podcast. We so appreciate your curiosity. This show was edited and produced by me, Nicole Fortune, and my partner, Mike Young. Background sounds and general cuteness provided by Smitty Jerome the dog and Miles Morales the cat. If you're listening on iTunes, please subscribe and leave us a review. It helps people find us. If you want to see video versions of sessions and or follow us on the social medias, check out our website, pillowfortpod.com. Do you or someone you know want to be in the Pillow Fort? Go email us right now at pillowfortpod@gmail.com. Is that good?
Yeah!
Yeah! Bye, y'all.